Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund, about family caregiving and living in the land of limbo, a collection of stories and poems that really speak to caregivers and their experience.
You know, we're all eventually, I think, caregivers, and I think the statistics we'll hear, you know, about how many, you know, 40 million in America. And I think caring for family members now has given me a lot more sensitivity and awareness of all of the dimensions and the range of emotions. And we get to explore these with Carol today. I'm so excited.
I am too. First, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about spine surgery and screening for anxiety and depression.
About how much sodium you should be taking, and are the experts right?
About bright light and a link to health.
And if you tell yourself I had a good night's sleep, does that mean you'll do better in performance tests the next day? We'll find out.
We will. Let's first talk about spine surgery. So, I mean, there's 600,000 major spine surgeries performed in the United States. And there are these guidelines that tell surgeons they should screen people for depression and anxiety before surgery, because the outcomes for people after surgery are really not as good for people who are still suffering from major depression.
This would ensure that if you have major anxiety or depression before you go into surgery, that it best gets treated, and how not to necessarily not have the surgery. And so the question is, well, how often are these guidelines, which are by major national authorities, followed? And this was research of in the Journal of Spine Disorders and Techniques of 340 spine surgeons across the country, and only about a third responded. So this is a best-case scenario, what we're about to tell you. What did they find, Christy?
The finding was that only 10% of orthopedic surgeons and neurosurgeons in this study follow these professional guidelines recommending routine psychological screening of patients before they do surgery for severe back and leg pain. So only 10% of them do this routinely.
And again, this is probably a best case scenario. The good thing was that those who were more experienced, if they had been in the field for more than 15 years, were more likely to use these tools, as well as those who saw more patients that did more surgeries, which really kind of says, you know, the people who are more experienced have started to learn this is important to use. So if you're a loved one, you should ask a friend or family member yourself undergoing the procedure, you know, take this into account, and hopefully we can work on our own guidelines. I'm sure, Christy, you and I have some things that we need to be working on, too.
Oh, absolutely. But in this case, if there is some anxiety or depression, it's worth trying to get that tended to and treated beforehand so you have the best chance of the best outcome.
Speaking of outcomes, this next research that matters is about the amount of sodium that is recommended by authorities, such as the Centers for Disease Control. And when we look at different studies, is that the right recommendations? Great question.
We have been telling people to cut down on their sodium intake for years and years. And I know, Adam, you and I have recommended this on the show before, I'm sure. But this is a study looking at these low and excessively low sodium diets and their association with higher mortality or death.
And so,
this is a meta-analysis. We should sort of explain.
Right, that meta-analysis of all these studies that have looked at this question. And it says the average American, 95%, has between 2,600 and 5,000 milligrams of sodium a day. And that particular range actually had overall better health outcomes than those with lower sodium. And unfortunately, currently, the recommendations are to have it less than the 2,600 if you're under age 50 and less than 1,500 milligrams a day for those who are over age 50, which suggests that maybe this isn't the correct advice. That doesn't mean if you've got high blood pressure that you shouldn't limit your sodium intake. But for the routine American, this may not be the right advice.
I know. I think certainly we need to investigate further and see what the CDC and the Institute of Medicine, what the big groups say about this. Yeah, exactly. But it makes me feel a little better for the salt that I'm going to put in my dinner tonight.
Well, certainly if you have high blood pressure again or heart failure, this doesn't apply to you. But for routine Americans, it may be important.
We're not telling you to go out and eat a bunch of salt, but we are saying that maybe that extremely low salt diet that you may have been recommended isn't as important or beneficial to you as we thought.
Next study, Christy, about bright light and body mass index. Does it matter about whether you can lower your body mass index, become less overweight, if you are exposed to bright light?
So this was research done at Northwestern University and in Chicago, where they took 54 volunteers to wear a wrist monitor, measure their light exposure, their sleep patterns, keep a detailed log of everything they ate. And in this, they found this relationship between morning light and body mass index, even independent of how many calories the participants consumed.
This was in the journal PLOS ONE. And, you know, it's interesting. This is only based on 54 volunteers. Yep. Most of these people were actually thin to start with, much thinner than actually a lot of my patients and my family. I'm not sure this is, you know, is there any downside to exposing to early light and exposure to light during the daytime more often? No, probably not. There's a lot of evidence that may be beneficial. Is it going to lower your weight? I'm not so certain about that.
Well, sir, we definitely need more study to understand it better. But there is some connection between light and the biology of your body. We know this in some, you know, links with mental health and having some light exposure for some people. And maybe getting up in the morning and getting a little bit of light and exercise, I mean, it really doesn't have a lot of downside.
You know what time these people went to bed on average, Christy?
Late.
1:20 in the morning, and they woke up at 9 a.m. I think these volunteers sound like college students.
Yeah, they might have lower body mass indexes just because they're young, and I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Well, let's talk about our very last research that matters, which is about placebos, the things we do or say, a shot, an injection, a pill, a word, or a counseling advice. Does that really impact the way people act and behave?
Okay, I love the study. But another piece of background is there was this survey in 2010 that of 400 doctors that reported 56% of them said that they had actually prescribed placebos to their patients.
You mean like a vitamin B12 injection? You knew it wasn't going to do anything, but you said, I think you need vitamin B12 to improve
it'll
your
help
energy
you.
Level.
Exactly. That sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But this was research in the Journal of Experimental Psychology, where they hooked up 164 students to equipment that showed how much quality sleep they got. And then one group of students was told in the morning they'd gotten above average sleep, that they'd slept well. And then the other group was told that they got below average sleep.
And actually, the machine actually didn't record sleep. This is the amazing thing. The machine did nothing, which I think there's kind of been some real ethical problems about that. But the interesting thing is that those who were told they got quality sleep did better when the next day than those who said they didn't get quality sleep. So clearly, being informed that you maybe did something that didn't or did not occur, because assumingly the sleep patterns weren't different for the two groups, might have an impact. I don't know, Christy.
Yeah, I mean, the students who were in the sleep study, if they thought they slept well, they were actually sharper when it came to how well they thought. There were really these connections. I tell myself in the morning that I got a good night's sleep because I need to frame it that way. But I don't know that it actually makes a difference in how well I'm thinking.
I look in the mirror and say, you look good this
it's
morning.
Like, you're
feel
awesome.
Great. It's going to be a great
you're,
day.
That's right.
I find those things don't hurt. I don't know if they help. Well, Christy, that'll conclude the research that matters. We have got a chance to talk about placebos, and maybe self-placebos aren't bad.
And about bright light and possibly being linked with health.
About for people who don't have high blood pressure, heart failure, the average sodium they get in their diet may be the right amount.
And about spine surgeons and this importance of screening patients for anxiety and depression before a major spine surgery. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund, about family caregiving and living in the land of limbo. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund, about family caregiving and living in the land of limbo.
Thanks for being with us, Carol.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be talking to you.
Now, you've gotten so involved in leadership and developing these partnerships between healthcare professionals and family caregivers. How did that bridging healthcare professionals and families and caregivers, how did that become your journey?
Well, it started, as many of these things do, with my personal experiences. I had a background in health policy and medical ethics and was coasting along very nicely, working hard, when my husband, my late husband and I were in a terrible automobile accident, and he was left with a traumatic brain injury and quadriplegic. And I became, although I didn't know it at the time, a family caregiver. And I took care of him for 17 years at home. So I think my personal interest led me to a professional interest. And even though he has passed on, I can't seem to let go of that, my professional interest
so at
all.
A lot of personal experience to draw from.
You know, it's quite important, this issue that you've are addressing in this new anthology of collections called Living in the Land of Limbo. It seems that virtually everyone I know, maybe it's the stage of life I'm in, is caring for someone. Is this a universal phenomenon? I mean, we know child rearing is, but if you have children, but what about this caring?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. And I, of course, I never know whether it's my job or whether it just comes about, but I seldom meet someone who does not have a caregiving story to tell me. And often it just comes up because, not because of what I do professionally, but just because it's so much part of their lives. And the latest statistics show that there are about 42 million Americans, I think one in four, is caring for someone who is chronically ill, disabled, and those are only adults. Now, there are, you know, others who are caring for children with chronic illnesses or disabilities. So it's very much in the air, and it's, as people live longer, all these situations arise, and most of us are just not trained to expect it or know what to do when it happens.
Yeah, I certainly want to get into your book and understand and break down a little more different categories and different types of situations people find themselves in. But with respect to bridging the healthcare givers' perspective and healthcare professionals, physicians, clinicians, what about that is the real need and became something that you want to address?
Well, I think certainly my own experience in caring for Howard, who was in and out of hospitals for various things, and my inability to get any kind of clear prognosis of what his life was going to be like, and then when I figured it out for myself, any real help at home, and I just felt so helpless. And I think many people, even in less, you know, less dramatic circumstances, feel that way. So I think that, you know, we really need to have a way for people to be partners with people who are taking care of someone or maybe taking care of someone with these illnesses or disabilities, to partner with the healthcare team and our work here at the United Hospital Fund has shown that it not only helps the family caregivers and the patients, it helps the staff. If you have an informed caregiver and someone who understands what's going on, can follow instructions, can ask good questions, they're better off too. So everybody wins, but it's a really hard culture change, and it's a really hard way of change in practice to get that implemented everywhere.
So let's dive right in. We're talking with Carol Levine, the editor and composer of a new anthology on caregiving called Living in the Land of Limbo. You say in this anthology, Carol, that this book is not about many things, which is unusual. Most people don't start out books saying, my book is not about diagnosis and treatment. It's not about training. There are not helpful tips in here. And I found that really remarkable. But you say it is about enrichment. Tell us a little bit about both of those things and why that's important.
Well, I think as a caregiver, and I meet many, many caregivers, and they're desperately searching for, you know, concrete things. How can I pay for long-term care? How can I get a home care agency to come in and take care of my mom so I can keep up with my job? I mean, those are real questions, and we do at the fund. We have a website that has guides for all of that stuff, and I write those things, so I know how important it is. But at the same time, I really felt there was a gap in the kind of deeper understanding of for caregivers and for providers of the diversity in caregiving and the really profound emotional state that someone who is a caregiver lives through.
Give us an example of what you mean.
Well, I mean the kind of ambivalence that caregivers feel. I know I'm doing the right thing. I love my parent or whoever it is, and I wouldn't not do this. But at the same time, boy, is this hard, and boy, do I get angry sometimes. The ability to kind of live, acknowledge those things as real human feelings, at the same time to do the job that you want to do, but that you want to do better. A lot of the tips and so forth for family caregivers is very much on the, you know, everything is fine, everything is going to be better, just have to do these few little things and life will be good. And I wanted to say, no, 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 you really have to dig in. You really have to learn how hard it is and what many people go through. And when you realize that you're not the only person who's felt this way, it's a kind of release. It's a kind of liberation. And I felt, frankly, that I wasn't the person to write that, but I was the person to put together the writings of fiction writers and poets who are, after all, that's their job, is to tell us about the human condition. So that's the rationale for why I said what the book isn't and what the book is.
And, of course, you used the word limbo, and you alluded earlier to feeling some of that way yourself as a caregiver.
Oh, I felt that way for so long because I never felt sure about what's going to happen, the uncertainty of it. And, interestingly, the title came from some writing by a physician, Arthur Kleinman, who's a well-known psychiatrist and anthropologist, who talked about families as living in the same land of limbo as patients, but that they're not recognized. And so I borrowed his words, and I said, this is exactly how I feel, exactly how I feel. I never know what the next day is going to bring. I can't plan for anything. And unfortunately, Dr. Kleinman is now in that land of limbo. He's taking care of his wife, who has Alzheimer's, and he's written very movingly about that. So, you know, it strikes everyone at some point or other.
I wonder if you can comment on one of the poems you have collected in your anthology. It's called Yesterday by W.S.
Merwin.
Yes. And you talked about this ambivalence, and I think Merwin describes this ambivalence about whether or not they should even be there or being there or not being there. It's not even about caregiving. It's about approaching caregiving.
Right, exactly. I love that poem. And I've heard a recording of Merwin reading it. And that's the one thing about poetry. When you hear it read, it has so much more meaning than reading it on the page, if you can find the recordings of it or the YouTube of it. And what he was describing was his own an encounter with a friend, and the friend's unwillingness to even step near the idea of caregiving, whereas Merwin is recalling his own father's death and that kind of going back and forth between the two of them. And it's just such a sad piece, that it's sad for the Merwin who lost the father, but it's sad for the friend who can't seem to connect with his own father. I think that's an example of the kind of ambivalence that I'm talking about.
Well, I'm sure it brings some comfort to your readers to be able to get some insights from people who've been through this and through stories and real stories that connect with people. We appreciate you taking this time to connect with us. We do need to take a short break, but when
Thank
we
you.
Come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund, about family caregiving and living in the land of limbo. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund, about family caregiving and living in the land of limbo. And Carol, before the break, you were sharing with us some of the stories and poetry in your book. And one of the ones that caught my attention and I thought our listeners would be interested in is this notion of paid caregivers and mm-hmm. their experience that is becoming more and more common as our families are dispersed. And you had one story about God's goodness, a short story. Could you just frame that for our listeners?
Yes, I thank you, Christy. I worked hard at including some stories about paid caregivers. And my own situation, I had wonderful men who were caregivers for my husband while I was at work. And I appreciated so much what they did for him and what they did for me. So I thought it really is important to include something about paid caregivers. But there wasn't a whole lot of choices, which is unfortunate. But this one story, God's goodness, is really very moving to me, because it describes a young Chinese woman, very young, who gets a job. She doesn't have much English, but she gets a job in a home where a young man who's probably 16 or so is dying, and the mother is having a hard time dealing with it, and the young girl comes in very religious, full of hope, full of saying that, you know, God will make this all better. And the young man, you know, teenager, saying, you know, no, I don't think so. You don't understand what I've got. And they have a dialogue over the course of his failing. And the piece that was so moving to me was, he's near death, and he says, you know, you see, God wasn't here. And she says, no, he was, because God brought me to you so that we could have this time together, and he brought you to me that I could learn from you about Einstein and about science. And I thought, what a beautiful way to portray that relationship, that both persons got something really meaningful out of it. So that was, to me, that was a surprising story, and I think a very moving one.
Well, you You say that, quoting, that fiction is much better for some things and that it can perhaps draw on some emotional truths better than the actual truth.
Yes.
Give us an example of how you
I recently had lunch with one of the authors in the book, Anne Harleman, who wrote the story called Thoreau's Laundry. And she has written a memoir about her late husband, and she's written short stories, a short story that's not about her husband, right? It's totally different. It's not about the main character. It's not a writer like she is. The main character is a woman who makes artificial ears and noses for people who've been injured. And yet there were things in that story, she says, that she could not have written about her own experience. And she says, she, in talking with other writers, that's the same feeling, that there are certain incidents or feelings or wishes that are not acceptable to say when you're talking about yourself or your own condition, but are okay in fiction, and that people respond to them. And there are certain things like personal care. There's one story by Rick Moody about this youngish man bathing his mother. I mean, you wouldn't put the detail in it in a memoir. You just couldn't. It wouldn't be appropriate. It would be upsetting. But in fiction, it can be done in a loving and sometimes in a not so loving way. But it's something that writers can do that memoirists can't.
We're talking with Carol Levine about her anthology of short stories, Living in the Land of Limbo. And Carol, as we think about this body of work and what it means to caregivers and professionals who read this, how do you see it fitting in? Like when we are taking care of people and our listeners are in that place of caring for a loved one and feeling exhausted, what are the resources out there, and how does this piece of work fit into that?
Well, I think, thank you for asking, Christy. I think that one needs to look in many places for the support that you need as a caregiver. You look to your family, you look to your friends, you look to your community, which is both, could be a religious community, it could be community agencies, and then you have to look beyond that into yourself, and what is it about you as a person that gives you the strength to do this? This is a hard job, and nothing is going to make it perfectly easy, but you have to build within yourself the sense of strength and of real commitment. And I think what these stories and poems do is say that this is a universal experience, and that it's okay to have negative feelings because you have all the other positive ones. But that, and some of these stories do have positive feelings. They're not all sad, but there is a sense of connection with a larger world. There's a connection with people who have nothing like you in the real world. I learned more about some of the difficulties of dealing with dementia, which I had not have to do, but I've heard a lot about it, from a story by Julie Otsuka about a Japanese-American woman who was interned as a child in California. Then I learned about, you know, then I would have learned about reading 10 websites about what Alzheimer's disease is about. So I think there's just a whole range of things that you can do to broaden your experience and to make it meaningful, which is, after all, that's what we try to do. We try to find meaning in what happens to us.
Well, we appreciate all of these things. And I guess maybe one final comment or a thought from you, maybe on a little bit of a lighter note, because you talk about kind of humor. You alluded to it in terms of the positive, the absurdity of humor. And I think about my own caregiving stories and with patients and how much we laugh in that kind of capacity. Is there one story, I don't know, Raymond Carver's Where the Groceries Went or something that where that humor comes out and you can illustrate for our listeners?
Well, I think the Raymond Carver's poem about, you know, where the groceries went is a little bit funny, but not, you know, not in the end, not too funny.
Sure. Yes.
The one story that I always think of as being rather humorous is by Gish Chen, who's a Chinese-American woman who
The third dumpster.
It's called The Third Dumpster. And this is, even though it's about a specific culture, it's so universal. The two sons want to fix up a home for the parents, and parents want to have nothing to do with that. They think they should move in with their sons. So they talk about, she writes about assisted living, and the parent says, we won't have anything to do with assisted living. They have lamb chops. They have salad. You know, they are only interested in their own Chinese food. And I thought, okay, what, they're Chinese, but it could have been my grandmother with Jewish food, or it could be an Italian family with their particular kind of food, or Southern family. It's, you know, it's those small things that people latch onto that prevent them from making a big move. So that story, even though it's kind of sad in a way, but in the end, it does have a lot of humor in it.
Well, for our listeners who are interested in either reading this collection of stories or accessing the kind of resources you've been involved in for caregivers, do you have a website or an easy place for people to access?
Well, there are two things I can say. First of all, our United Hospital Fund website, www.nextstepincare.org, has enormous resources for family caregivers along the lines of how to help find good home care, what to do when someone is in rehab, all of those kinds of practical help in navigating the healthcare system. Finding the book, I'm hoping that libraries will buy it so that people can take it out of the library and read it. It's also available. It's available as a paperback, not too expensive on Amazon. It's under $20. And as an ebook for people who use that mode, it's even under $10. So it's not a hugely expensive book. And it's the kind of book that you don't sit down and read from cover to cover. You pick it up, you read a poem, you read a story, then you put it down, and next time you pick it up, you read a different story. And then maybe you go back and read a story over again. So I think it will last a long time on somebody's night table.
Well, I think the love that you've put into this book and your passion is priceless, and we want to thank you, Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project of the United Hospital Fund, for really putting out this book about family caregiving and living in the land of limbo.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you both.
Coming up on House Calls, we're going to be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question or a comment that you'd like to send to us on an upcoming show, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to talk to us about our very first House Call today about an elderly patient in an assisted living facility.
My grandfather is 85 years old and lives in an assisted living facility. In the middle of the night, he apparently rolled out of bed and split his head open, needing 9 stitches. He has since returned to his residence, but has been sleeping for days on end. Can head trauma cause endless sleeping for the elderly, or should we just accept this as the person getting old and needing rest?
Well, we're certainly sorry that that happened to your grandfather, and we appreciate the question. You know, in my mind, if this is a change, if this is different than what he was doing before, ever since this bump on his head, then that could be a concussion. It could be a bleed in his head. It could be a lot of things that happened. I don't know if that was evaluated at the time that he had the trauma. But if he's sleeping more, it could be for a lot of reasons, but it could be because of injury to his brain.
Yeah, 9 stitches isn't good at any age, much less at 85 years old. And hopefully they did a CAT scan, but this needs to be evaluated. You know, I'm thinking of that song, Changes. This is not a good one. And we encourage you to get some follow-up. Thank you for sharing that and hope things have a good outcome here.
Let's take our next house call.
I listened to your interview with Dr. Anthony Vieira that aired a few weeks ago. I'm a 68-year-old male who was diagnosed with hypertension a little over a year ago. I, too, went from 0 to 9 medications, that is. I had lost 25 pounds in the last year, and I have maintained a healthier diet, but my doctor has not decreased the number of medications I was taking. Why can't I take fewer medications if I lost weight?
Oh, that doctor. You know, they're always in the way of you just having, you know, that's right. Well, you know, there can be a lot of reasons here. What are a couple of them, Christy?
Well, a couple of them could be that as you get older and just with age, blood pressure can be more difficult to control. And so you've made major strides with taking your medicines, losing weight, having a healthier diet. But it's more complex with that because you're also getting older with time. You have the genetics of your family as a part of this and the natural process that sometimes it does take several medicines. Most of the time it takes more than one medicine to keep that blood pressure down.
And we want to congratulate you on losing that weight. What a great achievement. I wonder if you're exaggerating just a little bit from 0 to 9.
Well, the 9 medicines must also include something
else. Yes, but we understand you feel like you're maybe on too many. And I encourage you to talk to your doctor about that. Your doctor will probably listen and maybe do a trial. I recently got someone off 2 blood pressure medicines when their pressure had been really good for 6 months. And it's always worth a try.
And sometimes, even if you can't come off of the medicines, there can be combination pills for blood pressure. So you feel like you're taking one pill, but it actually has 2 medicines in it.
We're tricking the mind.
That's right. But it just feels better when you're taking 1 versus 2.
Erica, what's our next house call?
3 weeks ago, I was involved in a car accident which took the life of a passenger in another car. Although I was lucky and survived with only a few broken bones, I have difficulty moving forward. I've experienced anxiety, for which I am currently taking medication for. Loud noises and the thought of driving myself are getting to be too much more than I can take. I realize I've been through a traumatic event, but I'm wondering if I need to seek some type of alternative help.
Oh, yes, that sounds terrible. We're sorry that you went through such a traumatic experience. And these symptoms sound like early, what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder, or symptoms of PTSD, which having a counselor or someone to really work through that with would be very important in addition to the medication that you're taking.
Yeah, we strongly encourage that. That's a way of moving forward. It certainly will take time, but boy, this is a really tough one for all kinds of reasons. And you know, you don't want to relive it every single day, multiple times a day. Mm-hmm. And that's what this post-traumatic stress disorder kind of does, is you start reliving things. And the more you do that, the more difficult it is, versus if you can do that less, you'll actually do it less often. So that's the goal of therapy. Thanks so much for a great question. And we really do wish you well and hope time heals.
Mm-hmm. Erica, what's our very last house call question for today?
Last summer, I had chigger bites. I unfortunately made the mistake of walking through a wooded area. They were solely on my lower leg until I started noticing what appeared to be small red dots accompanied with dry skin on the back of my heel. It doesn't hurt, but it hasn't gone away yet. It's extremely embarrassing, and I can't afford to see a dermatologist. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, this is an interesting question, Christy, because I'm not so certain if what happened last summer at the chigger bites is the exact same thing that's happening now, because you don't say they itch. And chigger bites itch.
They are so itchy. Chigger bites, thankfully, will go away on their own if you don't scratch yourself into the ground. But just getting yourself clean and trying to stay away from getting more chigger bites or taking something to help the itching helps. What you're describing on the back of your heel, I wonder if that could be some other kind of skin rash, like a eczema.
Yeah, it sounds like eczema, because you said you had dry skin. Mm-hmm. And little red dots are frequently like little small blisters from that really dry skin. We call it dyshidrotic or foot eczema.
Mm-hmm. And that would be treated differently with a steroid cream or some topical coverage ointments that could...
Moisturizing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So...
Even a fungal infection would be treated differently, antifungal. So good
luck.
True.
Yeah. We wish you the best. And we really appreciate you sharing your story with us. And stay out of that wooded area, because chiggers, man, those things itch.
Well, we want to thank all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you, and you can email us at yourhealth@uncedu.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or get our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Carol Levine. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll both look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.